Station number 5190, Lieutenant Colonel Cyril Luckin, Reel 4.
Right, well, I'm trying.
Well, personally, I never took any leave that one could have had, probably up to a 24 hour, I'm sorry, and up to probably about a fortnight per annum if you had wanted it. But as there was nowhere to go, I don't think people really bothered. You must remember that it wasn't too strenuous a time, even for ourselves. Taking the ordinary infantry battalions and units of that, they had a very, very cushy life of it. That they worked in the mornings and that was all. There was nothing doing enough. They were either sailing or swimming or picnicking or playing tennis in the afternoons. And unless you were fairly well off and be able to pay a fare, there was nowhere that you could go. We used to have a number of picnics and outings. One of the Admiralty tugboats or one of the small boats would go round to Clearwater Bay or Deepwater Bay and so on. Occasionally get on the boat and go over to Macau into Portuguese territory and have a look around the gambling saloons, etc. and so forth. But there was no sort of continuous leave because it really wasn't necessary.
Did any people take their leave in Japan or anything like that?
Oh yes, no, there's quite a number that did, you know.
Yes.
But I mean, personally, it was beyond me because I was, except for the last year I was there, and that didn't make a great deal of difference financially. I mean, I was only a lieutenant. I'd got a son at home here in Liverpool, and a wife and daughter to keep, etc. and so forth. We hadn't got very much money to play around with. We could manage quite comfortably, but you hadn't got any surplus around.
You mentioned that you lived in service flats. Were there, in fact, any married quarters?
When we first went there, I think there were no more than about three on Hong Kong Island, which would probably be about the commander-in-chief's quarter and perhaps a couple of brigadiers, that's all. We did build married quarters out at Stanley for the simple reason that it was absolutely necessary because it was so far away from anywhere else that you couldn't possibly send the people out there, and the married people were there out quarters out there. So they did start to build. But in the main, you see that the officers and the families, we had to find our own accommodation. But it was a very efficient organisation. I mean, the various headquarters are in touch with all the owners of these blocks of flats that ran services. And for the other ranks, those that had their wives and families there, they rented flats for them in Kowloon and so on. Just paid the rent, but it wasn't War Department property.
What were messing arrangements like? Were there any messing arrangements?
Well, as far as we were concerned, no, because you got all your meals well provided with the flat. There were service flats. They did all your catering, etc. The same boy that looked after your flat and looked after you also waited at your table.
I see. And for the rest of the time, what sort of communications did you have with home, with the UK?
Well, not too good for the simple reason that was very nearly 6 weeks. It took about 6 weeks for a letter to get from home to Hong Kong and back. No, you didn't get much in the way of communication at all. I mean, we were dependent on what was going on purely from there. There was a local radio station that put out a certain amount, if you had a radio to listen to, which very few of us had. And of course there was the Hong Kong Times, I think it was, China Gazette, which we relied on for news, but it was all pretty well out of date by the time we got it.
So you weren't really aware of what was going on in Europe, or not even aware.
We were aware that all sorts of funny things were happening, but I think inclined to dismiss it because you were so far away and you knew so little that it didn't ring a bell at all. You know, that's a world away. We're only concerned with really what is happening here. You know, we were much more concerned with what was happening up in Shanghai or somewhere like that than we were what was happening in Munich.
Yes. What I mean, when you say you were more concerned with what was happening in Shanghai, what sort of things were you referring to?
Well, you see, because you yourself referred to it when you came down before, that you see you'd got this struggle was then going on between Chiang Kai-shek and various, I suppose you call them rebellious warlords who were trying to undermine his regime, and of course you had got the growing communist. So that there was always, sporadic fighting on one side and another going on, but nowhere near Hong Kong. It was all further north or more central China, etc. and so forth. I mean, yeah, Chiang Kai-shek had got a completely firm hold over all the southern part of China, so they didn't really affect you.
Yes. And so you had no suspicion that there might be a war in Europe, or a war with Japan, in fact?
I was rather dubious about Japan because, quite frankly, I couldn't see what they were going to gain by it. Because history would prove to you, as Napoleon and various other people had learned, that nobody could occupy China. Damn place is too big. I mean, you just couldn't do it. You might stage a war, you might defeat them, but you couldn't occupy it, you couldn't take it over. Personally, I always felt that there was going to be a bust up in Europe again somehow. I don't know why, but I always did.
But it never seemed likely to you that Japan would be involved with the Axis powers?
No. No. I doubt whether anybody did in there, because as a history proved, it seemed to be such a mad thing to do when all said and done, to attack the United States as they did, because they couldn't possibly win. I mean, they might have inflicted a very nasty defeat on them, etc., and so forth. But obviously the states wouldn't take that lying down, and they'd hit back. And eventually they'd lose out. Okay. I've never been able to follow the Japanese line of thought on that at all. I mean, how on earth they ever hoped they could do it. I mean, we know they had this idea of the Southeast Asia Cooperative Zone, etc., and so forth. If it had been staged by a purely communist regime, then it might have come off, but not on the national basis that Japan was organised. No, I've never been able to follow that at all.
What was the level of awareness of the Chinese political situation like among the troops in Hong Kong?
I doubt whether one paid much attention to it, for the simple reason it was too confused. Absolutely. I mean, you just didn't know who was who. I mean, one knew that Chiang Kai-shek was in firm control of the bulk of China, but you had these various, as they call them, warlords, appearing in the news, and for about a month this bloke was quite the boss, and then somebody pushed him out of it, and somebody else had a go, that they were merely names to you, and They referred to places which you, well, you couldn't even find them on a map. But I think that one took but very little notice of it at all.
Yes. You mentioned, actually, when I was talking to you last time, something about the colonial allowance that you were paid on top of your money.
Well, that was just a sideline. That means that you go back quite a bit. That, and it'd be 1932, that's right. That in 1932, this country took a very drastic line at the height of the Depression, which, as a matter of fact, I wonder if this government hasn't got guts enough to do it. And they cut the services pay and the civil services pay. It wasn't a question of not giving us a rise, they simply cut it. I think about 10% or something of that nature. And, well, that was that. Well, now, I went to, I was due, we used to get an additional rate of pay after 4 years commission service. I was due for that in 1933, that's right. And it's 1933 they cut the pay, so they, I got a nominal increase plus a cut. So I finished up exactly the same as I was before, and I didn't get any more. Then I went out to Hong Kong, and I think it was in 1935, or at the latest, 1936. The pay cut was restored to the services. Now, in addition to our service pay, if you were serving overseas in various places, you got what was called a colonial allowance, which, on paper at least, was paid for by the colony. That is to recompense you for the additional cost of living, you know, that's what it would be at home. Well, in Hong Kong, when the service pay was restored, they promptly cut our colonial allowance and said, oh, you're getting more money now, so we don't have to pay so much. Yes, that created an absolute furor, because we pointed out that this is absolutely heinous, because it meant that the people serving, say, in the United Kingdom or anywhere like that where there was no colonial, they had got a rise in pay. Whereas, if you were serving overseas, we got a rise in pay and a cut in the colonial lands, and we were back where we started from. After about a couple of months of hectic argument, that was smoothed out, and they did pay up and give it back to us.
What currency were you paid in?
Hong Kong dollars.
You mentioned that...
Well, let's say we paid in Hong Kong dollars. That's strictly speaking. Well, it varies. You see, with the officers, of course, you don't get paid in cash at all. I mean, it's paid into your bank. So, I mean, with all the Royal Engineers, well, Lloyd's Bank rules dealt with our corps. So that our pay was paid into Lloyd's Bank here in London. You know? And you could just draw on their bank out there as you wish.
And there was a brief disturbance of the currency you mentioned last time when Chiang Kai-shek issued
dollars. I'm not quite certain how it all happened, but I mean, we had quite a stable currency in Hong Kong. The dollar was roughly about 1/6 to in our currency. Now, Chiang Kai-shek then started a silver dollar, and he had probably some millions of these struck, I don't know, and that didn't suit the Americans, so they promptly went off the silver standard, which of course devalued the whole of these coinage, and overnight everything, all coinage vanished altogether, because everybody impounded it and hung on to it. You know? So So that for about 2 or 3 days in Hong Kong, we never had any money at all. Nobody had it. They had to come out with a very hurriedly printed little Hong Kong $1 note, etc. and so forth.
When was that?
It would be about 1937. I know we've got one or two of the Chiang Kai-shek's dollars here.
Were there any other effects you could discern of the unstable situation on the mainland affecting Hong Kong? I mean, for example, I think you mentioned that General Motors moved to Hong Kong from Shanghai.
There was a very distinct movement of big business, moving from Shanghai, which of course was the centre really of almost the communist business when all the trouble was arising. And they were pulling out of there and coming down and setting up their offices in Hong Kong, and then as being a more stable surrounding in which to carry on business.
Do you remember any other companies which moved?
No, I couldn't remember that one. I know particularly because I got to know the manager, what they call the Far Eastern representative. I got to know him very well because he came to live in the same block of service flats as we did. And he lived next door to us, and we got very friendly with him. But there was a lot of them, of these big firms, of Mathers and Jardines, the big shipping and dockyard people, and they brought more of their work from Shanghai down into Hong Kong, and gradually moving it out and bringing it down there as being a better bet than remaining up there where things were very unstable.
Did you ever hear your friend from General Motors pass sort of opinions on the political situation?
No, I never did, because he was really, that was his job. That he was there to sell vehicles, and he quite happily sold vehicles to Chiang Kai-shek and any other warlord that liked to buy them. As long as they produced the money, he'd produce the goods. But politically, they were not on one side or the other. There's no reason why they should be. I mean, that's an American setup. All they're great for business.
Did he do his deals in Hong Kong, or did he go into the interior?
As far as I know, he never used to travel very much, but he had got any amount of other representatives, of course, scattered around in China, because the gentleman I'm talking about was what they call their Far Eastern representative. He's quite a big noise in his own way. They probably got another 20 or 30 representatives in different.
So, when did you finally leave Hong Kong?
I came home in March 1938 as Senior Surveyor Works Designate to the Southern Command, rather funnily here in Salisbury. But for various reasons, I never took up the appointment because the War Office decided they were not too happy with things up in Scotland, so that we eventually finished up in Scotland again in Edinburgh. But this time back as a major, as the senior surveyor of works for the whole of the Scottish Command.
So during your time in Hong Kong, you'd been senior surveyor of works for China?
I was acting, yes. But I got my captaincy in 1937. My 8 years was up then. Then I came back and I went up to Scotland, and I jumped quite a number of people then, and I was given the local rank of major to take up the SSW's appointment in Scotland. And I remained up there really during the whole of the war. I just missed going out on the original expeditionary force in 1939, because every officer normally in the army, anyway, you had what they called a mobilisation appointment, which you held for 12 months. And I think I came home and I went up to Scotland just about the somewhere about August 1938, and I was then senior surveyor work designate to the British Expeditionary Force, if there ever was one, you see. Well, as it happened, my 12 months ran out just at the beginning of in September 1939, and reverted to somebody else, so that when the war broke out in 1939, I'd done my 12 months on tap, and somebody else went and I didn't. So there was that, and I remained up in Scotland right up until I went out to Germany in 45.
And in Scotland there were various troops, weren't there? What countries were they from?
Oh, well, I think we had pretty well everybody up there. We had the Poles up there, we had the Free French, we had the Norwegians up there at different times, and I think those were about the three. I don't, there's a few Dutch naval people. I don't remember seeing any Dutch land forces up there at all. And of course, we had a very large number of all sorts of hush-hush establishments going up in Scotland at that time. We built two ports, Port Ryan, Port Loch, Gaelock. Then we built two known as Port A and Port B. Port B was the one that, where they tried out the little midget submarines, which eventually did there. We tried out the whalebacks, which were eventually used in the Mulberry Harbour. We tried those out in the Solway Firth. And, we had the commando assault training places up there, and all sorts of places hidden away in the lochs and the glens, etc. And of course we had the, from my point of view, I mean we had the response, we got the Clyde and the Forth, the Western Approaches, Scarpa Flow, the Orkneys, right up to the Shetlands, etc. and so forth. So we had a very big commitment as regards accommodation, batteries of all description, counter bombardment batteries, heavy anti-aircraft. We built a whole lot of piers here, there, and everywhere. Whole camps capable of housing two or three battalions at a time. We built a big anti-tank range down at Kincardine, down Kirkcudbry, I should say. Sorry, down at Kirkcudbry. Oh, it was quite enough to keep one busy. Spending millions of pounds at a time.
And at the end of the war, you went to Germany.
Yeah.
What did you do then?
Well, very much the same thing, except that on the face of it, it was a bit of a problem. That this dates back to the... Are you all right for time? This dates back to the 40s. When they had the Rhine Army in 1919, which went on till about 1925 or 26, that they used to place contracts direct with the German nationals. And they found later that that was a very foolish thing to do, for the simple reason that the German currency, as you know, collapsed completely until you wanted a suitcase full of money to get on the tram with. That we had got the liability of paying these contractors in sterling. Well, somebody quite rightly said, well, when we finish this war, we're not going to get caught like that. And so that my main brief as SSW to the 21 Army Group was that the question of we would need a whole lot of work done, new barracks, new all sorts of, well, every model thing would be required to be done, but under no circumstances was the His Majesty's government going to accept any form of liability to Germany for this. So that we had got to devise a method by which the German authorities would have to carry out the work and accept full financial responsibility for it, but we would say what we wanted, where we wanted it, and how we wanted it. So that was a little bit of a problem. But we got over it in this way, that we used to go, we wanted to say a new barracks. We just drew up a plan, an outline plan, showing the extent, the accommodation that we want. You would then send that to the Bauamt, which would be the equivalent of the borough surveyor in this country, and tell him to call for tenders in their own German method, which he would do. And then, when he'd got them in, if it was a very big job, they came down to me, but otherwise smaller jobs were at various levels, etc., etc. You looked at them, etc., and so forth, and you said, well, you might say, for some reason or other, that particular firm is not acceptable to us. We know something, so you can strike him at. So you would say to them, right, you will accept that particular tender, that one, which he did. And, of course, it was then valued at so many thousands of Deutschmarks or whatever it was. And they went ahead and they did the job. Now, there was never any money passed directly from the British authorities to them at all. They had to pay the contractor. But they would come to me at the end of the job and point out and say, well, our contract was so-and-so. It's now gone up to so much. And I'd say, oh, yes, how much? You say, well, why? And I'd say, well, we were instructed to do this instead of that, etc., and so forth, and that caused extra costs. And say, yes, sir, that's agreed on that one, this and that. Then, of course, we were up against the trouble of the fall in calorific value of the German ration. As the calorific value fell, so the output fell, so that we had to allow them more, because it took more labour to get the same amount of work done. But it eventually would finish up with saying, well, all right, you started off with 500,000 Deutschmark.